Welcome to What Does Good Look Like, the podcast that brings you healthy care experts with unique insights into what good looks like and what you can do to get there. I'm Anna, and I'm co-hosting this podcast together with Will. Together with our previous guests, we've started to unpack some of the basic concepts of healthy care. First, Professor Andrew Scott helped us realize why this is so important. Most of us will live for a lot longer than the generations before us have done, so we really need to prepare for this by designing our lives differently. And this includes investing in our health throughout all of life. We then spoke to Dr. Jack Kreindler about the growing amount of evidence behind lifestyle medicine, the field of medicine that is looking at how lifestyle interventions such as diet, exercise, stress and sleep impacts our bodies and the pace at which we age. Our next guest is Dr. Sophie Cassidy, a researcher in lifestyle and chronic disease. We invited Sophie here to help us go beyond the latest exercise trends and fad diets and get a better understanding of where the scientific evidence is really at. What signs should we be looking for to tell if our bodies are aging quicker than they should? And what can we do to stop it?
As a short bio, Dr. Sophie Cassidy is an exercise physiologist from Newcastle University. Most recently, Sophie was part of the research team on the BBC TV series, How to Stay Young, where they tested the health of members of the general public. By showing the participants a measure of their biological age, or body age, instead of their chronological age, they produced a real slap-in-the-face moment, demonstrating why the participants really needed to focus on their health starting today. And I would well advise you to watch it. The broad view is to show how changes to diet and exercise can have a huge and lasting effect on individual people and benefit the whole population. Welcome, Sophie. It's great having you on the show.
Thank you very much.
We first came across you from watching the BBC series How to Stay Young, which I think we'll come back to in more detail later in this conversation. But your day job is not to do TV shows, but being a researcher in lifestyle and chronic diseases. And while doing the research for this interview, we came across a couple of quotes that you've made elsewhere that really intrigued us. So I'll just mention what those two quotes are. The first of which is that we're living longer than ever before, but we aren't aging well. And then the second one was, as shown on the BBC series How to Stay Young, you note many people are living unhealthy lifestyles and making their body age up to 30 years older than their birth age. So I think that this conversation is going to be fascinating for a lot of people, partly because I think that for many it's going to be a surprise just how much actionable information there is regarding healthy aging, which means we really can affect the rate at which we age. And also a lot of us can now access this information and improve no matter what stage of life we're at. So that was my long rant. To get started, I think it'd be great if you could just explain your job to a layperson and how did you get into this field in the first place?
Yeah, thanks, Will. So researcher looking at, as you said, how we can use lifestyle interventions and healthy lifestyle behaviours to treat, manage and prevent obesity and age-related chronic disease. So particularly looking at type 2 diabetes, fatty liver disease and heart disease. And the reason that I got into this, so I've always been fascinated with how the human body works and particularly how it responds to exercise and diet. And so I studied exercise physiology at Leeds University, where I was really interested more so in looking at how we use exercise to prevent disease rather than looking at how exercise can improve professional sports and athletes. So a lot of people who do that course go into that field. I was more interested into the in the clinical aspect. And really looking at obesity-related diseases. And a few statistics I remember when I was studying my undergraduate really stood out to me. For example, a third of people in England over the age of 35 are now obese.
And not just overweight, but obese.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that is constantly on the increase. And it's scary because, for example, obesity is the second biggest cause of cancer, for example, after smoking. So there's a number of different issues and problems with the rising tide of obesity and overweight individuals. And I think I started to realize that we live in an obesogenic environment. So it's actually really hard to prevent this rising tide in obesity. So I wanted to do something about it. I was fascinated in it. And I got the opportunity then to do a PhD under Professor Mike Trunnell at Newcastle University, which was, I loved every minute of that PhD. It was great. And what I particularly looked at in those 3 years was high intensity exercise in type 2 diabetes. And then since the PhD, so I'm now 5 years on from that, I'm looking at a number of different exercise, lifestyle, nutritional interventions in not just diabetes, but now I've expanded that into, as I've said earlier, heart disease and fatty liver disease and generally age-related or obesity-related chronic disease. Yeah, so that's my background. Hopefully that's
helpful. A fascinating background.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, it's kind of implied in the word, isn't it, that lifestyle related diseases tends to accumulate with time because it's impacted by the lifestyle that you have. So I think that's also the sort of link to aging. That's why we also sometimes call these diseases age related diseases. So we call this podcast, What Does Good Look Like? But we like to start off by inverting this question and ask what bad looks like. So in terms of aging, how would someone know if they're aging badly? Like, what signs should one be looking for?
Yes. And before I get into that, I think it's helpful to define a couple of terms. So when we talk about aging, there's kind of two things we talk about. So primary aging or chronological age is obviously a natural thing. We're all getting older each year. And that's the progressive deterioration that we see in our bodies. So for example, our hair can turn gray, our eyesight can get worse, and people lose muscle mass, okay? And I think it's important to define that first of all, because part of aging well is actually, I think, accepting that natural aging process. But what I'm interested in is the secondary aging. So that's looking at the accelerated deterioration in our body age. So for example, you might be 50 years old, but you actually have a secondary age, or we also call it biological age, of 70 years old. So my main interest is trying to extend people's healthy lifespan, so the number of years they are actually disease free. Does that make sense? So
yes.
It's a nice classification, yeah. I think that's great.
I think that's important to just distinguish, because we can't stop our bodies aging, but what we can do is prevent years where we have chronic disease. That's kind of what I'm interested in.
And I think that's really important, because I think a lot of people, when they think about aging, maybe they gray hair. And of course, that's something completely natural. But
exactly, yes.
There may be these other signs that you don't even realize is maybe due to that, especially that accelerated aging that you mentioned.
That's right. Yeah. So I would generally go to two main things to look for. So the first one would be quite simply obesity. So especially if you have a waist circumference that is above what it should be, that would be a sign that you're not aging well. So for women, that would be over 80 centimeters. For men, that would be over 94 centimeters. And the reason that we're talking about waist circumference is because it's a really good indicator of abdominal fat. So fat that is stored around the important organs. So if you have high fat storage around that abdominal area, you're more likely to have diabetes and heart disease, because it affects the function of important organs like the liver or the pancreas. So that would be my first thing to look for. So simply obesity. So you can use BMI as a measure as well, but waist circumference more accurate. And the reason that obesity is bad is because it accelerates the aging process on a cellular level. And I'm just going to list a couple of things that we know it does, and more evidence is showing us. So for example, obesity accelerates damage of the DNA. It also leads to chronic inflammation within the cells. And it also increases the amount of insulin, which is a hormone in the blood, which leads to a number of diseases. As I've already mentioned, type 2 diabetes is the obvious one. So overall, what we get is this accumulation of cellular garbage, as it were, within the cells, and that just accelerates the aging process. So obesity has a number of detrimental effects, and especially when we look on a cellular level. Okay, so that would be my first sign to look for. My second sign would be inactivity. So it's becoming more and more clear that as we get older, people are becoming less active. And so the latest statistics suggest that in the UK, only a third of people are active enough over 75 years and over. So especially that older generation are becoming less and less active. So if you're not doing the 150 minutes per week of moderate activity that the government recommend, then that's a sign that you're not aging well. You need to do more. And also, you should be doing probably a couple of resistance exercise sessions per week as well to maintain that muscle mass, which we know declines with age.
On that point, do you see cause and effect? There's a long discussion around, does inactivity, is that an effect of something else, or is that the cause of many of these problems? Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, so it would be, in my opinion, the cause. So we know in large-scale studies, when you control for other risk factors, so when you take out the equation, obesity, diet, and other smoking and alcohol factors, which we know increase the risk of disease and accelerated age, and if you take those out of the equation, there's still a strong association between physical inactivity and chronic disease and accelerated aging. For example, there was actually last week or 2 weeks ago, a big study published in Norway, and they followed the activity patterns of individuals over 20 years. And they found that those who led a physically inactive life for 20 years had a twofold greater risk of premature death when compared with the physically active people. So there is more and more evidence suggesting that physical inactivity in itself has an impact.
That's interesting.
That's clear. Mm. But sorry, I interrupted you. I think so. You've classified, so your waist circumference is one thing, your level of activity is another.
They would be the two major signs I'd start with. Diet is very much linked with obesity, but we can kind of go on to talk about that in a little while, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think first of all, I'd go, okay, what's your waist circumference? Are you obese? Because that's going to accelerate your aging. And are you inactive? They're the two main things I would go to. And that's what a lot of my research is around as well.
And when you mention exercise or being physically active,
yes,
what type of exercise is it that people need to do? Are we both talking aerobic sort of cardio exercise as well as resistance training, or is it one of them, or does it matter?
That's a really good question, and there's a lot to it. So I think my first response would be doing something is better than nothing. So any activity is better than nothing. In fact, again, a recent study showed that any level of activity, whether we're talking about light walking, moderate running, or vigorous high intensity training, is reducing premature mortality. So any of those help that aging process. And I think the major public health message has to be around moving more and sitting less, rather than focusing on particular types of exercise. However, as an exercise physiologist, I know that there are clear benefits to different types of exercise. So for example, high intensity training is really good for heart health, but it's not any better for losing weight than walking, for example. So it's really good for stimulating the heart and getting people to reduce their blood pressure or the structure of the heart and various risk factors, but it doesn't actually lead to improved reduction in body fat. Then there's resistance training, which, as I mentioned earlier, I would always recommend people to be doing resistance training, especially over the age of 40, because we know from that age onwards, your muscle mass does decline. When a lot of people ask me this question, and what I generally say is, if you can meet the moderate levels of activity that the government recommends. So a 30-minute walk a day, I would always recommend walking, is so good for you. But I would then say on top of that, if you can do a couple of sessions of resistance training and then a couple of short bursts of high intensity exercise. So whether that be walking up flights of stairs to get your heart rate rising or just a couple of burpees, that can be all that you need to do. But I do think you need that variation in intensity for maximal benefits.
I would agree. I mean, just from an observational point of view, we've been testing this Freestyle Libre continuous glucose monitor. It was fascinating to see the effect on your blood glucose of different types of exercise. So when fasted, I did a high-intensity session and it went up to 12 millimoles. So this is really high for anyone that doesn't know. When you go on a long, slow run, you can just see a slow decline in your blood glucose levels. So there must be very distinct physiological effects from different types of exercise. So I think...
Absolutely, yeah. And I think I'm weary to kind of go down the route of prescribing and getting everyone to do certain types of exercise, because I think when we're too far from that, like as a society, we just need to get people walking. We just need to get people active. So that should be the major kind of public health message, I think, and before we kind of talk about the intricacies of what certain exercises do.
Start with the basics.
but I think that's a good take home message that, you know, any type of exercise is better than nothing. If you're already exercising, there are things you can do to sort of further maximize the benefits. But if your starting point is that you're not really exercising and you want to get started, it doesn't have to be that complicated. Just go out for a walk.
I think the NHS did a really good one with their couch to 5K. I mean, just a simple message.
Fantastic. Yeah, definitely. And there's been a huge explosion in kind of park run and that sort of thing, which getting people even just to walk the park run. And actually the study that I mentioned earlier about the decreased premature mortality with, you know, it's non-linear. So what I mean by that is you reduce your risk of premature mortality to the greatest extent when you go from no activity to doing some light activity, rather than the risk reduction we see from people who are already kind of moderately active doing high activity. So it's better to get people at that low end who aren't doing anything, getting them moving. It's really important to be doing that.
And do you see that this is now accepted in general practice? Do you start to see that this has been prescribed?
I think it depends where you are. I'm currently in Sydney, and I think, for example, Australia are ahead of the times in clinical practice than we are. I think it is becoming more and more observed in clinical practice, especially dietary interventions. So there's a lot of work now in intermittent fasting and reducing calorie intake, which really has huge impacts on chronic diseases like diabetes, fatty liver disease, heart disease. So that's quite an exciting area that I see growth in.
And you see growth that even in general practice, and you see that doctors are prescribing this intermittent fasting?
Not yet, but I don't know if you are aware of, so in Newcastle, Roy Taylor is big in diabetes, and the Diabetes UK funded their biggest trial so far. The results were published in The Lancet not long ago. And what they did is they did the very low calorie diet in primary care. So they rolled it out across practices in Newcastle and Glasgow in patients with diabetes. And what we're seeing is incredible remission rates. So up to 50% remission rates in individuals with type 2 diabetes. Now, if that was shown in any kind of medical trial with looking at drugs, for example, it would be huge. But this is purely just getting people to reduce their calorie intake, albeit it's a significant reduction. So we're talking about 800 to 1,000 calories a day for 3 months. So it's a big ask for individuals to do. But the impact is huge, and we're seeing not only kind of improvements in blood pressure, improvements in blood glucose, we're seeing actual reversal of diabetes. And this was done in clinical practice, not just, you know, 12 individuals in a tightly controlled research environment. So I think we're still a long way off from that, but evidence is, has shown from this trial, for example, that it is possible.
That's fascinating. And I guess you do need to do it with a clinician, because if you're on drugs, if you start fasting,
yes,
there may be an effect that is not so good, hypoglycemic.
But that's right.
Was this the guy that worked with Michael Mosley on the 5-2?
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yes, Roy Taylor. Yeah. I've worked alongside him. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, he's done a lot of good work. I think the intermittent fasting story is fascinating. It's the one intervention that we see in non-human primates and rodents that extends lifespan by a significant amount. So up to, 50%, you see these huge extensions in lifespan. The difficulty is when we try and translate that into humans, because how can you do a study on humans for kind of, getting them to reduce their calorie intake all of their life and seeing if it extends the lifespan. But probably the biggest trial, which was done, was over 2 years, where they got healthy, normal weight individuals, so aged between 30 and 50. So they got them over a 2-year time frame to reduce their calorie intake by 25% over those 2 years. And what you see is huge benefits on a cellular level. So almost opposite to what I said obesity does on the cellular level, intermittent fasting almost reverses that, even if you're not obese.
Wow.
So things like reducing inflammation, reducing DNA damage, reducing insulin, all of these things which we know have downstream knock-on effects within the cell, and ultimately reduce that accelerated aging. So I think intermittent fasting is a fascinating area, especially even in people who aren't obese. It's got huge health benefits.
Yeah, and I think it's good also from a sense that it's maybe easier for a lot of people to implement, because it doesn't mean that you have to buy lots of different types of food that you're not used to, or learn
yes.
how to cook lots of new tricky recipes, or
yes.
you're not able to eat the same type of food that the rest of the family is eating if you're living in a family. So maybe, I don't know if you quickly want to explain what intermittent fasting is if someone doesn't know.
Yeah, so generally, I mean, there's lots of different ways of doing intermittent fasting, but essentially we define it as going for periods without any food. So a very common model would be the 5-2 diet. Most people have heard of the 5-2 diet. So you have 2 days where you either completely fast, so you don't have any food for 24 hours twice a week, or some people do. So that some people do have like 500 calories of non-starchy veg, for example. And so there's not one type of intermittent fasting, if that makes sense. Some people like to do it every other day, which is a lot. But it's basically reducing your calorie intake for a set amount of time.
It actually then leads on quite nicely to, so we go back to the original question of what good looks like. It kind of, to my mind, brings two things into play. So what would healthy aging look like to you? And also in people that you've worked with, how big of a change have you seen moving from bad to good?
Yeah, so I think the flip, so what would good look like is the flip of kind of what bad looks like. So first of all, maintaining a healthy weight. And we've touched on one really good way of doing that is, it's watching how many calories your body's intaking compared to how many you're expending. So intermittent fasting is a good way of calorie control. Eating the right foods is also really important as well. So the Mediterranean style diet has the most proven health benefits, we know that. So filling up on vegetables, whole grains, seafood, pulses and nuts, and then reducing your kind of processed foods and sugar sweetened beverages, things like that. So we know the type of food is also important. And then thirdly, being physically active. So one thing that I've started to realize more and more is I see quite commonly, middle-aged individuals, I think, who are time short, so they have a lot of demands on their time. So they're raising a family, they've got a busy job, for example. They're the people who seem to do their exercise session even daily. So they'll go out in the morning and do a run or do a circuit session. But then the rest of the day, they're sat at a desk. And I see this pattern more and more. And actually, what you get is these people who we call active couch potatoes. And actually, a lot of these people are doing circuits and they're overweight, and I'll look at them and think, well, something isn't quite right. And this is because we know more and more that actually you can't substitute for the lack of activity in your whole day. If you're just doing, say, a 45 minute exercise bout in the morning, for example, and then you sit at your desk all day, we call this a lack of habitual physical activity. And so studies have shown that, for example, a nurse or a waiter, someone who's on their feet all day, could actually expend up to 800 calories a day more than someone who does their exercise session in the morning but then sits at a desk all day. So I think what we really have to, so someone who is physically active, I'm not just talking about someone who's doing their exercise session, but it's someone who is mindful throughout the day of standing meetings at work, going for walking meetings, taking the stairs, not the lift, and not being that active couch potato that I see more and more in our society, because we live in such a sedentary environment.
That's a fascinating point, because I think actually for a lot of people, you think you're physically active, you go to the gym on a regular basis, you've got it covered, right? And so you can happily sit in front of the TV for hours on end, binging in the evenings, because you did that session at lunchtime. Absolutely. Or in the morning at the gym.
That's right. And we know that exercise in itself isn't the best way to lose weight. Diet is more effective. So, for example, if you want to burn off a Costa caramel shortbread, you have to do a 50-minute intense run. I mean, that's quite difficult to do. So generally, when we're focusing on weight loss, we really need to be talking more about reducing calorie intake by diet, because exercise is actually really hard to expend the amount of calories you need to expend. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think, but maybe it's worth exploring that just a little bit more, because I think if you've never calorie restricted through things like intermittent fasting, you probably think it's you're actually going to feel really lethargic and it's going to be painful. But I think for a lot of people, actually, they find the opposite, which is they get a burst of energy during the fasting period, but also they see the benefits afterwards.
That's right. Definitely. Yeah, I think, this whole kind of active couch potato is, I don't know, I've noticed it more since coming to Sydney, and I don't know why. I think it's very prevalent all over. But particularly middle-aged women, I've noticed it in a lot. And I think it's this overcompensation that you do when you've done your exercise session, as you've just said. You feel great about you getting up at six to do your circuits, but then you go and have that extra cappuccino and you don't realise the calories that are in that, plus the caramel shortbread. So yeah, I think that's one thing. So in terms of being good and aging well, it would be being active, but being aware that exercise doesn't substitute for being sedentary all day. You've got to reduce your sedentary time as well. And one more thing that I'd like to talk about is just the importance of walking. So I think people neglect how beneficial walking actually can be. And there was a really nice article in the Guardian recently, just showing that they're seeing more and more that brain health is strongly linked to walking outdoors. And obviously, as people age, brain health is a huge thing they want to kind of think about and improve. And so it seems to be that during movement, we can detect now theta brain waves. So it's like a pulse in your brain. And it has a lot of effects in terms of assisting learning and memory and those kind of things. And also during exercise, it seems that you produce essential brain nourishing molecules, which we call BDNF. And the article describes this as something like a molecular fertilizer produced within the brain, because it supports structural remodeling and growth of new synapses after learning. So walking outdoors is also something that I always really recommend, not only just for heart health and physical health, but it seems to be more and more evidence suggesting for brain health as well. It's important.
So for everything.
And how about sleep?
Yep. So sleep is another risk factor that it's important to control. I think one study, I remember in my PhD, my supervisor, Mike, got me to look up this study, and it just blew my mind. So it was in 1999, it was published in The Lancet, so one of the big medical journals. And they took a group of young medical students who were males and got them to sleep. So they used to sleep 8 hours a night. And for 1 week, they got them to sleep 4 hours a night. And within that week, those healthy young males went from being normal to pre-diabetic. So their glucose control was all over the shop after that week of 4 hours sleep. And the reason for this is because sleep is such a tight controller of hormonal balance. So during sleep, it's not like your body just shuts down. There's actually loads of things, restoration and things that occur during that sleep period. And we also know that it affects hunger hormones. So if you sleep badly, you're generally going to be more hungry during the day. So then it obviously links to obesity as well. The problem that I see is as you get older, often people do need a bit less sleep. And so especially around menopause time, women can struggle with waking up really early in the night. And I think it's just being aware of that, so not becoming too stressed about that natural process. But we know there are things you can do in your day to stop unhealthy sleep patterns. So trying to avoid napping throughout the day, trying to avoid screen use before bed. Those are things that we always encourage individuals to do. But also being aware that sleep is does change as you get older as well. That's important to remember.
The tips for sleeping better that Sophie just mentioned is what we often refer to as sleep hygiene, and this is always a good place to start. However, for people with severe sleep problems such as insomnia, sleep hygiene is often not enough. But there are techniques that are effective for that as well. And if you're interested in improving your sleep, you should know that later in the season we will be speaking to Dr. Hugh Selsick, a sleep medicine consultant running the UK's largest insomnia clinic, which has had such remarkable results that there is now a 2-year waiting list. We won't keep you waiting for that long, but we still have a lot of interesting topics to cover with Sophie, as well as some other guests, before speaking to Hugh. In next week's episode, Sophie will tell us how the BBC series How to Stay Young came about, what they learned from it, and give us a glimpse into the work behind the scenes. We'll also find out which tests Sophie recommends for finding out how well your body is aging, and what changes she has made to her own life based on what she now knows. So if you haven't already done so, make sure that you subscribe to the What Does Good Look Like podcast so that you don't miss this or any of our other upcoming episodes. If you have any questions, comments or feedback, we'd love for you to get in touch. You can reach us directly via email, podcast@meliohealth.com, or if you make a post on social media, please tag us using WDGLL. And if you do like our podcast, please help spread the word. You can share episodes with friends and family directly from your podcast app, as well as leaving a rating or review to help even more people find us. Join us in discovering what good looks like so that you and your loved ones can stay younger for longer.